KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Nopa.
I'm from Pittsburgh.
I live in Ingleside.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, BART proposals to keep riders safe have some activists and community leaders on edge.
BART is already testing software that can, without any humans involved, identify suspicious packages.
Then a family conversation about the value of a traditional dance heritage.
The ancestors that come from Central America and Mexico, you're always going to have that because you were raised in danza.
And Arturo Magaña didn't know how audiences would feel about two men dancing Mexican folklorico together until that one night on stage when everything changed.
In dance, I was never given the opportunity to represent myself.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. BART riders are on edge after a spate of killings on the system, including the brutal stabbing of 18-year-old Nia Wilson. In the wake of the violence, the transit agency announced plans for a $28 million security action plan. That proposal includes a ban on panhandling, a fierce crackdown on fare evasion, and a ramped-up surveillance system. KALW's justice reporter Holly J. McDeed is joining me now for the details. Hi, Holly.
Hi, Hannah.
So how big of a safety problem is BART facing?
So last month, three people were killed on BART in less than a week span. So that is very clearly concerning. After those killings, BART's police chief, Carlos Rojas, described the murders as an anomaly, which they are. Killings on BART are rare. Mm-hmm. And actually, a few months prior to these deaths, police were defending the agency's response to violence on the system, saying that violent crime and robberies had decreased compared to rates seen last year.
Mm-hmm.
But what's still worrying is the long-term trends. So violent crime overall on BART has risen nearly 70% from 2007 to 2017. That's according to an investigation by the San Francisco Chronicle.
Okay. Do you have any idea why that is?
Well, police say that they're understaffed. And meanwhile, BART police are having to deal with a growing network spanning multiple cities, 100-plus miles of tracks. There's a lot of ground to cover there.
Mm-hmm.
And as stations are expanding, ridership's going up. Police staffing is not getting much bigger. There are only some 200 officers for this entire system. And police would need to hire at least 25 more officers to get staffing up to where it needs to be. Meanwhile, a lot of officers are set to retire in the next couple of years.
Okay, so it's growing. There's not enough police. So riders really can't always count on BART police then for being there to stop a crime or to respond to a crime.
Exactly. And there are those who want BART police to be more present. But then there are others who don't trust BART police, who don't trust the agency.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of examples for why they might not feel comfortable trusting the agency. So, for instance, BART had launched a crime reporting app back in 2014, and East Bay Express investigation showed that this app has been repeatedly used by riders to report homeless people.
Uh-huh.
Riders have also disproportionately reported Black people for alleged crime. And BART's record on transparency has not always been great. After a fatal attack on BART in 2016 at a West Oakland station, a San Francisco Chronicle investigation revealed that BART had been using dummy security cameras on many of its trains.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the longstanding mistrust of police in communities of color, especially after high-profile BART police shootings, like the shooting of Oscar Grant and, more recently, Shaleem Tindall.
So lots of skepticism about BART police. How has BART responded to this rise in violent crime?
So BART has responded by hiring more officers, trying to lure them in through bonuses and things like that. And another big thing they've been trying is vamping up crackdown on fare evasion. So last year, when a mob of 40 to 60 juveniles jumped the fare gate, they robbed several passengers, and that got a lot of people talking about how fare evasion can be this gateway to more serious crime.
Mm-hmm.
And BART's police chief, Carlos Rojas, has actually said that if they could figure out a way to crack down on fare evasion, then perhaps they could stop a majority of these serious crimes that are occurring on the system.
Okay, so what else are they doing?
So the East Bay Express has reported that at Lake Merritt Station, BART is already testing software that can, without any humans involved, identify suspicious packages or alert police when someone jumps a turnstile without paying. This conversation around fare evasion was revived after Nia Wilson's death. The suspect who had killed Wilson had been stopped for fare evasion in the days before her murder and was arrested at a BART station the day after. The family's lawyers say BART's failure to stop criminals, like the convicted felon in this case, led to Wilson's death. They filed a lawsuit against BART, saying that the suspect should never have been permitted to enter the BART system. He should have been stopped at the turnstile and turned away. But at the same time, this conversation around fare evasion is reviving a debate among activists and advocates who don't want Nia Wilson's death to be used to criminalize people who can't afford to ride BART.
And has BART made any immediate changes after this murder?
Yeah, they have. There's more police presence at stations. Meanwhile, BART's board of directors has voted on a plan for increased security measures, including emergency call boxes at stations. Right now, they're exploring the purchase of digital cameras for the system, and they're encouraging more people to use the BART Watch app. But that may only be the beginning. The board is also considering a broader policing policy.
So what would that include?
So that could include cameras that can connect with Wi-Fi so police can view footage in real time. It would basically be a system-wide monitoring of passengers. It would also include video screens that basically alert patrons that they are being watched. They're also considering a ban on panhandling in paid areas, which people are also concerned is another policy that could target poor people, especially poor people of color.
So is that likely to pass?
Well, at the last BART board meeting, there was a lot of opposition. Almost everyone who spoke was opposed to different components of the plan. And that's part of the reason one of the BART board members proposed that they move the next meeting to a suburban location to hear the other half of the story from friend riders who are afraid to use the system. So the board agreed with that proposal, which means that there's going to be another hearing scheduled for September at a suburban location, which will bring the debate over privacy and safety there.
Interesting. Thank you, Holly. Holly J. McDeed is our justice reporter. You can reach her at justice@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This next story comes to us from San Francisco StoryCorps. It's not always easy to pass down family traditions, but that's what Maria Sanchez and Roberto Vargas are trying to do. For both of them, Danza Azteca traditions have been important for honoring their Mexican and Nicaraguan cultural heritage. In 2014, the couple sat down with their then 12 and 14-year-old children for a talk about ethnic identity and why danza is so important to them.
My name is Roberto Ariel Vargas.
My name is Tonali Vargas.
My name is Yadira Vargas. I like to go by Chela.
My name is Maria Isabel Sanchez.
We could ask you, love, to begin the conversation. What do you identify as your ethnic background?
I still identify as Mexicana. I have not become a citizen yet. I do want to become a citizen, but I like calling myself Mexicana.
And I'm curious for our kids, since your mom and I identify differently, I identify as Chicano, Nicaragüense, Centroamericano, Nativo, Azteca, Mission District Native, all those things. How about you all? What do you all think are our family traditions that we're handing down to you?
I think danza is a big part. I don't like it. I like seeing people dance, but I don't like having to go every Monday for 2 hours in loud drumming. Sometimes it's nice to be dancing, but I don't like how we're kind of forced to do it.
And you, Mijo?
I like watching it. I like the people who do it. So I respect it, and I don't mind helping out. It's just, personally, I wouldn't want to continue these for myself.
I hear what you're saying, and it's good that you're forming your own opinion, your own observations on what traditions you want. What we, as your parents, are doing now, we came into having the Danza Azteca traditions through an enlightenment of being educated around our ancestors' histories. We don't go to Catholic church, but we go to danza. That's the way we give thanks, and that's the way we connect to our ancestors from Mexico and from Central America.
Every Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, on the 1st of November, we stay up all night, we prepare the altar, we sing songs with the elders, with dancers from all over. They come together to be in ceremony with us. And then we dance as the sun is coming up. When I was your age, I guess, I had some small connection to the Catholic Church. But later in my life, you know, I found the danza.
Yeah, when I was 19, there was a lot of reflection, but also a lot of pain that needed to be processed from being brought from Mexico and my grandparents raising me. You know, I dropped out of high school and was able to get back into college, and I had to work very hard for that. And part of that was my mother seeing how hard she had to work and all the, you know, the violence that she had to go through just coming to this country, having me at age 14. There's a lot of things that go into finding my space of identity at 19.
You know, we've gone back and forth, like, wrestling with how much do we make you be a part of danza? How much do we let you do your own thing? I don't like that y'all haven't been dancing or drumming lately. I do want y'all to drum and dance again. But what I at least feel good about is that your mom and I at least gave you these traditions, and you know some songs, and you know some danzas, and you know how to behave yourself in the sweat lodge, and you know how to behave yourself in our ceremonies, and you know how to pray, you know.
We're danzantes. We're Mexica danzantes of the ancestors that come from Central America and Mexico. You're always going to have that because you were raised in danza.
Those were the voices of Maria Sanchez and Roberto Vargas. That San Francisco StoryCorps piece was produced by KALW's Judy Silber. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. This song is El Son de la Negra. It's one of the most famous folk songs in Mexico. It's one of the many songs that can accompany baile folclórico, traditional dance. Down in San Jose, a group of LGBTQ dancers are expanding a tradition by adding their own stories in folclórico. Reporter Leslie Griffey met up with one of the group's founders to find out how.
Ready, five, first line, footwork and skirt work. Five, six, seven, go.
It's a hot evening in a San Jose studio where more than a dozen dancers move to the music. The troupe is warming up for its rehearsal of its first full-length show. The new piece, complete with original choreography, is called Tradition Without Borders. The show includes a performance by a dance troupe visiting from Mexico. Dancers spin around the floor. Some dance the male role, known as the boot, stomping their feet with their hands on their hips. Others twist big, bright skirts into the air, making the fabric twirl. The movements are the folk dances of Mexico. They differ from region to region. Here's Colibri's co-founder, Arturo Magaña.
We do everything exactly like any other traditional or non-traditional or contemporary folklorico dance company.
But the stories these dancers tell with their bodies are a little less traditional. Some of the dancers wearing skirts are men or people who identify as gender nonconforming.
It's not just because we can. It's because we are basically telling a story. You're going to see a coming out story, which is also a very, very beautiful piece. And it's all put together and curated through Mexican folklore.
This Folklorico troupe tells LGBTQ stories through dance. Arturo's love of Folklorico really begins in the United States 30 years ago. His family moved here when he was about 14. When he danced Folklorico in Mexico, he wasn't a fan. But when he rediscovered it in San Jose, it felt like home. Folklorico is a term that covers traditional regional dance from throughout Mexico. In the early 1900s, it became popular as national pride swelled following the Mexican Revolution. Throughout the years, Folklorico incorporated influences from a variety of cultures, like European and African dance. In San Jose, Arturo worked and studied so hard that soon he joined a professional troupe.
I remember being so excited. I mean, I couldn't have enough time in a day to dance. It was such a feeling of accomplishment.
But something was still missing. Arturo performed pieces from all over Mexico, from passionate Norte pieces to difficult Jalisco dances. But every time, he danced with a woman, as is traditional. But that's not what Arturo wanted.
In dance, I was never given the opportunity to represent myself as who exactly I was, which is ironic because I was representing an entire country. But as I grew older, I thought, you know, my story is just as important as a heteroconforming story.
So about 3 years ago, a friend convinced Arturo that he should tell his own story through Folklorico, not the heteronormative story. He should dance his experiences.
Nowadays, with the gay movement, with the equal rights, gay marriage and everything, it was the perfect timing.
But just because the timing was right didn't mean it was easy.
This person from Mexico actually went onto our page and said that we should be sanctioned, that what we were doing was an insult to our country.
Despite resistance, Arturo knew this was something he needed to do for himself and for his community. Dancing out, as Arturo puts it, wasn't something he had seen before.
I remember thinking, like, what are my colleagues in Folklorico going to think? It was scary because, you know, you never know if people are going to insult you.
Arturo tapped into his network of friends. He put word out on social media. And through that, dancers of all levels of experience begin to show up at rehearsals. For a while, Colibri was careful about where they performed, just Arturo and a few friends dancing in front of gay-friendly audiences at community centers and pride events. About a year ago, Arturo and another dancer decided to step in front of their other community, the dance community.
This was the very first performance that I was going to step in front of just the general community, not a gay event or any of that. And we were going to dance just the two of us. We were going to do a solo, a Norte solo, and, you know. And I remember the song started, and we didn't even want to touch hands. And we started dancing, and it was very timid, and Norte is a very strong region. And I remember the both of us looking at each other and thinking like, oh my God, what are we doing? This is really scary. And as we continue dancing, then I heard the kids like clapping for us and saying, hey, 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 and giving us a lot of excitement, egging us on. And in that second, everything changed. It was almost like pushing us out of the closet and saying, look, people are here to receive you. All the fear that we had was really inside of us.
Let's go ahead and get ready to run the show, starting...
Back at the studio, there's a lot to do to prepare for the performance. The troupe is in hour two of rehearsal, turning, spinning, and stomping before the mirrored wall. During the day, these dancers are doctors, teachers, and more. But once they come in the door, each person becomes a colibri, Spanish for hummingbird.
And we're depicting our stories because they matter.
Through their dance, Ensemble Folklorico Colibri hopes to add a new story to a beautiful tradition. In San Jose, I'm Leslie Griffey for Cross Currents.
You can find tickets to the Ensemble Folklorico Colibri show, Tradition Without Borders, at klw.org and click Cross Currents. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. Go do it. The Cross Currents team includes Muna Danish, Janae Darden, Nina Gensler-Debs, Sarah Kaust, Lisa Morehouse, Emma McAvoy, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Marissa Shea, Bo Walsh, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Shireen Adil is our content manager. Jen Chien is our managing editor. And Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll take a look at the modern face of a Chinese-American tradition.
I don't wear fake lashes every day. I don't, you know, wave consistently when I'm walking down the street. I don't greet every single person like, hi, how are you? Welcome. Happy Chinese New Year.
Miss Chinatown, USA. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KELW News. This music is by San Quinn. He's performing this Friday night at the Back Bar Sofa in San Jose. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Pala.
Much love from the SFC. Handle bricks in the back of Candlestick. House in Twin Peaks, you panoramic. Still with the cannon, 40 or 50 caliber. Five-time champion, destroy any challenger. Hit like Barry, score like Jerry. Still right here, feel more than Mary.